Welcome to How Positive Are You, episode 26. Today we are very pleased to have with us Nancy Turner Bangos, Harvard-trained MD and author of the new book, AIDS, Opium, Diamonds, and Empire. Hello and welcome to our show, Nancy.
Hi, how's everyone?
Thanks for joining us, Nancy.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for having me.
We begin with just a brief introduction of Nancy because we want her to tell her story in her own words. Nancy is a Harvard Medical School educated MD. She practiced obstetrics and gynecology in New York City for a number of years in the 1980s and I guess into the 1990s. Is that correct, Nancy?
Yes, that's correct.
And now she...
And also the suburbs.
In the suburbs. She lives in the right now in the Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C., where she's been for much of the last decade. She also has a master's degree in business administration from Pace University in New York. I'm going to let her tell us why she decided to get an MBA as well as an MD, which is a kind of an unusual combination, but it plays right into her concerns about the greed part of her AIDS, Opium, Diamonds, and Empire book, and along with her medical science expertise in confronting the single pathogen theory that a little bug caused all of the disease and death among gay men in the 1980s through the early 1990s. So, Nancy, let's begin by your telling us your story. How, as a physician treating women in New York City and the suburbs in the 1980s when the whole AIDS crisis arose, that it led you to question the HIV/AIDS theory?
Well, one of the things that happened was that my best friend actually was a gay man who was diagnosed with HIV. And in retrospect, I realized he was given AZT and probably died as a consequence of the AZT. And it was very devastating to me because we were very close. So, but I really was listening to what the medical experts had to say, and as they came to the hospital and they talked to us, and they were telling us things that, like AZT was, they had tested it in pregnant women, and it was okay to give this toxic drug to pregnant women, which at that time I thought was strange because we had been taught not to give anything that could be damaging to the pregnancy to pregnant women. But I didn't think too much about it at that time, except that they said it was sexually transmitted, and as you know, gynecologists are the doctors who deal with sexually transmitted diseases, and I simply was not seeing any of it in my practice, and neither were my friends who were also OBGYNs.
And they were all in New York. And they were all in New York City.
And they were all in the New York metropolitan area, and so in the city and in the suburbs. So it was a combination of doctors in both areas. So we were not seeing women who were HIV positive. And one would think if this was going to be the sexually transmitted epidemic that they said, that's what we would have been seeing that in our clinics. It wasn't happening. So about 8 years ago, I moved to the Washington, D.C. area, and now this is about 20 or so years later. They're saying that black women are the group of people who are the fastest growing group for HIV, and I was in AIDS, and I was going like, that's bizarre, because sexually transmitted diseases generally spiral out from a community into a contiguous community. For example, if the predominant group are white males, then the next group next to that group would be white females, because there are about 20% of people who are bisexual. And so you would suspect that you would see a lot more HIV in white females, and they were saying it was in black females, and I thought, oh, that's odd, because that doesn't make sense from an epidemiological point of view. So that's when I really began to look into this, because there were just a lot of things that I was hearing that didn't make sense to me.
That brings us into your 1980s until you moved to the Washington area. Tell us a little bit now about, you had these epidemiological concerns. Tell us a little bit about your concerns from a simple standpoint of medical science about whether a retrovirus could be causing a breakdown in immune systems.
Well, what, you know, one of the reasons that, I moved to this area was to, well, several things happened. One of the things that happened is that I became ill, and so I had to, leave my practice. So I had to figure out how to heal myself.
Now, let me stop you here and make sure that we understand the nature of your illness. It had nothing to do with HIV or AIDS, right?
Right, exactly. So I had to start looking at other ways besides drugs to figure out how to bring myself back to health. And so in bringing myself back to health, it began to occur to me that allopathic medicine, that even though we were learning chemistry, biochemistry, and physiology, we really weren't applying it in a clinical setting. We were only giving people drugs.
Define allopathic, because most people will not understand what that means.
Yeah, allopathic is the predominant medicine practice in the world today, and it basically consists of drugs, surgery, and radiation, as opposed to other types of medical disciplines such as homeopathy, which use very tiny doses of medication to give to people, or naturopathy, which uses mostly herbal kinds of medicine. And certainly there is Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine, which is practiced in India. So there are many medical disciplines, but allopathic medicine happens to be the predominant discipline practiced in the West.
And that has something to do, does it not, with how we fund physicians. We give them reimbursement, insurance companies do, if they prescribe drugs, if they take office calls that prescribe drugs and prescribe tests, as opposed to reimbursing them for wellness education of their patients. Is that not correct?
Well, absolutely. I mean, people must understand that the pharmacy, it is the titans, the financial titans, the Rockefellers and Carnegies, who really established the allopathic medical system at the beginning of the last century. And basically because they also owned the pharmaceutical companies. So it was a way of supporting their business model. And they basically funded those medical schools which would, in fact, teach the allopathic model. And it was a way of supporting the idea that they wanted to sell drugs. So indirectly, they were promoting the sale of drugs through the financing of medical schools.
And allopathic medicine has also spent a lot of effort suppressing other forms of medicine, calling them quacks and you know, using the legal system to get rid of their competition, like chiropractors or naturopaths or whoever it is that they don't like at a particular time.
Yes, people don't have no idea how much they've suppressed other disciplines, but several years ago, the chiropractors won a big lawsuit against the allopathic medical tradition when they were trying to be suppressed by the allopaths. So, yes, not only that, many individual doctors who have come up with therapies that actually have worked to cure chronic diseases, including cancer, have been called quacks and sometimes lost their licenses or been forced to go to Mexico or other places to practice.
I think if you think as a patient, the listener thinks of themselves as a patient going to a doctor, the doctor has a conversation with you and maybe tells you how to eat right or how to get plenty of sleep and to exercise. Then the doctor says, here's your problem, and you can solve it by taking this drug, or we can do this test for you. An insurance company then sees the paperwork on this and can apply a code to the diagnosis, to the test, to the cost of the test, to the fact that a drug has been prescribed, and therefore the insurance company can decide whether or not to fund the drug. But it's pretty hard to apply a code to a soft conversation about telling you how to heal yourself, telling you how to take care of your health. And so the whole structure of the insurance reimbursement system pushes doctors toward doing things they can get reimbursed for. And a simple conversation about your wellness is not something they can get reimbursed for. It's not really any sort of a complicated question here. It's because we've reduced everything to computer codes. There's not a good computer code for intelligent conversation, apparently.
No, you're right. There really isn't. And the other thing that happened, especially after the health maintenance organization model became very prominent about 15 years ago, is that the reimbursement to doctors went down, and they had even less time to really sit down and talk with patients in a way that would make sense for the patient or the doctor.
Let's get to the medical science portion of this. Tell us how you were became skeptical that a retrovirus could cause a disease, any disease.
Well, first of all, retroviruses have never been known to be pathological. They just weren't. Subsequently, retroviruses have been found, perhaps not even to be viruses. They may be actually messenger packets of information that are used by the cells inside of the cell or between the cells. But at the time, they were defined as these viruses, but no one had ever shown that they could cause cancer or any sort of pathology. And the war on cancer that Nixon supported spent millions of dollars trying to prove that these viruses could cause cancer, but they never could prove it.
And that's where Dr. Robert Gallo comes in, because he was running one of the cancer investigation related to retroviruses operations at the National Institutes of Health. He had been working about a dozen years on this theory and really had come to a dead end. Now, he had claimed some tiny relationship of one of his retroviruses to a certain type of very rare cancer, but mostly he'd spent 12 years not being able to come up with anything on his theory. And another guy who had been doing some of this research was Peter Duisberg, who actually had a relationship with Gallo, and a good one for a long time. Gallo had actually praised Duisberg, and Duisberg became the central character, as many people who listen to this podcast know, in questioning the theory that a retrovirus could cause cancer. That a retrovirus could cause HIV, cause AIDS.
Well, Duisberg actually was a thorn in the side, I think, of the people who wanted because they wanted to find a way to make vaccines, because they can sell, if you sell a vaccine, you can make a lot of money. And so this idea of viruses was being promoted. It was being promoted as a way of selling vaccines, because that certainly is a very big money-making thing. And so Duisberg, first of all, came out because they were trying to prove that these retroviruses cause cancer, and Duisberg came out and said it's not happening. And then when he came out and said that that HIV could not possibly cause AIDS, that was like the final straw. They said, okay, it doesn't matter how brilliant this guy is, you know, he's putting a damper on our machinations here. And so that's when they begin to isolate him. But the problem with Gallo is that Gallo really spent a long time. Gallo wanted the honor, and he wanted the glory, and he spent a long time trying to prove this particular theory, and it wasn't working. So when people started showing up in the emergency room with these various illnesses that the first people showed up with, they decided that it was going to be a viral infection, even though the history of the people who came showed that these people were toxic, and Gallo essentially was going to be the person who would come up with the theory of what was causing these problems. I think he was chosen because he really wanted the glory, and he had a particular personality type that would allow him to do what he's done.
And would allow him to actually service the political needs of the Reagan administration at the time, in 1984 we're talking about, which was being criticized for not being sensitive to gay men dying. Ronald Reagan wouldn't mention the word AIDS. So Ronald Reagan was running for re-election, and they were seeking some way to blunt all of this, and steps in Robert Gallo at a government institution, and Gallo very willingly and eagerly steps forward with, here, I've got the explanation for what's causing this gay cancer, and it all followed from that. David?
Yeah, it's interesting that Gallo, to be more explicit, has a very aggressive personality, and his other alter ego, Luc Montagnier, Pasteur Institute, from which Gallo derived a lot of research in ways that were less than above board, Montagnier is a total coward. Montagnier obviously has a lot of criticisms of the AIDS paradigm, which come across in your book, Nancy. When push comes to shove, he'll always go with the mainstream. And also, Gallo, prior to HIV, he had appropriated research from Japanese researchers on a virus he called HTLV-1, which he claimed caused cancer. And also had a bit of a debacle with HL23V, which you document in the book as well, Nancy.
Exactly. And the interesting thing about HL23V, the people, many researchers came out and criticized it in the same way that researchers have criticized his HIV research, and he backed down at that time because they said, okay, there really was no isolation. And really, for the HIV, his isolation was certainly not any, his so-called isolation was not any better, because it's clear from reading what happened, and certainly reading Janine Roberts' book, Fear of the Invisible, it's clear that he never really isolated.
So we have, in the middle of the 1980s, a researcher with questionable credentials, with questionable ethics, promoting almost at the behest of politicians a theory that took root when what I call a science challenged mainstream media, and as a journalist I have witnessed this over the years, unable to critically assess whether this theory made any sense or not, immediately running with it because the world wanted an answer. Why were these gay men dying? And gay men wanted an answer. I'm gay, in the late 70s, early 80s, were engaging in behaviors, warehousing ourselves in urban ghettos as we fled the countryside, as the love that dare not speak its name became out and proud. We were sort of engaged in sort of an incestuous cohorts in urban areas in which we were literally exchanging incestuously and repeatedly with multiple sexual partners, old pathogens, syphilis, gonorrhea, hepatitis, and we were treating ourselves almost with prophylaxis with antibiotics, which were themselves immune suppressive. At the same time, we were engaging in a partying kind of lifestyle in which we were fueling our nightlife with toxins, with recreational drugs, alcohol, poppers, nitrites, amphetamines, all of these things, immunosuppressive. And then finally, just to complete this bit of history, in the early 1980s, we were the victims of an emerging religious right that were making us a hated minority, which caused all kinds of fear, anxiety, and depression as we were dislocated from family and friends. So what you have, and what I'm describing here, is the multifactorial explanation for the breakdown of immune systems. Old pathogens, toxins.
And I think that's what happens, with a lot of diseases. People are toxic from a long history of lifestyle and also environmental things that we don't even think about. I mean, we don't think about the flora in the water. We don't think about the vaccines that we are taking. We don't think about, and certainly the antibiotics, which you mentioned, we don't think that those antibiotics could be a problem. But the problem is as you discussed, that there was a long period of time that a certain segment of the homosexual community was engaging in behaviors and also taking a series of toxins consistently into their body, which over time allowed this breakdown. And if one reads the social history of the early people who came into the hospital, you can see that the in some of the early doctors understood that these were toxic problems.
Joseph Sonnabend actually was one of the early doctors in New York to see these patients, and he actually, I think, understood. He has veered off that right now for reasons that we don't need to get into, but I think he really understood this multifactorial theory that was the real reason for the breakdown of the immune systems in a subset of gay men who eventually had their immune systems collapse and who got the opportunity to get illnesses and who died. And that phenomenon really was occurring from the early 80s until the early 1990s at the latest, when it subsided.
One of the things I found fascinating in your book was how you linked another protagonist we haven't mentioned yet into the story, and that's Burroughs Wellcome, which we now know as GlaxoSmithKline. Burroughs Wellcome made the paupers. Burroughs Wellcome made, I think, what's called ceftobactrim. And Burroughs Wellcome made a transplantation drug that you had some connection with, Nancy. And Burroughs Wellcome, just one second, Burroughs Wellcome also made AZT. So maybe you can discuss its role in this whole crisis.
Yeah, one of the things that I discovered, because I remember when I was an intern, I did an internship in general surgery, and we had a transplantation service, and we had patients who were getting kidney transplants. And one of the things you have to do with people who are getting transplants is that you actually have to immune suppress them. And the reason you immune suppress them is because you don't want them to reject the transplant. So you give them a series of drugs. And one of those drugs was a Burroughs Wellcome drug, and it was called azathioprine. And what I found when I reviewed the transplantation literature is that some of those transplant patients develop what I call transplantation AIDS. That is, they develop Kaposi sarcoma, they develop opportunistic infections, they could develop lymphomas, and also the interesting thing was when the azathioprine, which was this Burroughs drug, was withdrawn, even though they continued on other immunosuppressive drugs, that what happened is that sometimes the Kaposi sarcoma, which could be disseminated, actually reversed, and the opportunistic infections could be treated. So we already knew from the transplantation literature that people who were immune suppressed could be reversed.
And that's something I had noticed a while ago, and I wonder if some people, perhaps quite innocently, looked at the diseases that were emerging in this in what was originally called GRID, or gay-related immune deficiency, and said, well, gee, we see those same diseases in transplant patients who are immune suppressed, so it must be a disease of immune suppression, even though the Kaposi sarcoma is probably got nothing to do with immune suppression. It's probably another toxic side effect of those drugs.
The basic problem is not really immune suppression. That's a secondary issue. The primary issue is an energy deficiency problem, because what happens is that living organisms are able to store energy, but because of the toxins in the environment and because of the lifestyle, what happens if we're not taking in the proper nutrition, we're not getting the proper sleep, or we're continually taking in toxins, we begin to use up our energy stores in such a way that we can't replace them. And as a result, over time, we begin to develop various diseases depending on what our disposition is. And so if you step back away from the immune deficiency and go into the energy metabolism of the cell, then you can begin to understand what the core of the problem was.
Let's explore a little bit the whole question of African-American women and Africans allegedly succumbing to this, quote, HIV disease or to AIDS. Describe a little bit about what we're really seeing there and why people of African descent are more likely to test reactive to the set of proteins in the blood that are called a marker for HIV in the blood.
Well, one of the things that I found interesting in the transplantation literature is that because when you have a transplant, they have to tissue type you to get a match. You know, that's why they say a family member is the best. And in the tissue typing, they look at various proteins on the surface of cells called lymphocytes. And one of the protein markers that they found in the patients who were developing these Kaposi sarcomas and opportunistic infections, which was HLA-DR5. Now, I don't want to make that complex, but it's just an immune marker. It's a tissue marker. And the interesting thing is it just happens to be more common in certain ethnic groups. It happens to be more common in African Americans and in people from the Mediterranean area. And it just so happens that the HLA-DR5 protein is this, it matches the identity of one of the proteins, the P32, which is one of the proteins on the HIV antibody test. The other issue with African Americans is this. African Americans, genetically, just as African Americans have darker skin, they also make more antibodies to a given stimulus. And the antibody test, interestingly enough, is a test based on dilution. That is, they dilute it much more than any other test, so that people who have higher antibody titers, no matter what the problem, are more prone to have a positive test. And so people of African origin have higher antibody levels than Caucasians. And so consistently, the HIV antibody test is 5 times more positive in people of African descent than they are in Caucasians.
Which helped with this theory that AIDS had come from Africa, that it was ravishing the black community, that somehow being able to find blacks in America strengthened this crazy theory that people like Gallo came up with, that AIDS had emerged from monkeys in Africa.
To me, when I hear something like that, I think, you know, there's a theory at the beginning of the century called eugenics that basically, it was not just a racist theory, it was also a class theory, that certain elitists felt that they had the right to tell other people whether they could live or die or have children or not have children. And it sort of culminated in the Second World War with the death camps. And it kind of went underground, but it never really went away. So when I hear, as an African American, when I hear something like that immediately makes me think, who is talking about this, and let me see who these people are, because that is a propaganda ploy.
To put this all in historical context, modern historical context, we have a medical phenomenon affecting mostly white gay males in urban enclaves, New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles. And then we have these predictions because this gay men wanted this for funding purposes to try to figure out why we're dying, to be everybody's disease so that white heterosexual politicians could come up with appropriations. Gay men very quickly embraced this idea that it was a single pathogen as a way to make it everybody's disease. And we saw all these predictions in the early 1980s that millions of heterosexuals were going to die from this disease. It never happened. It never crossed over into the heterosexual community. So move up the clock, and now we have the disease jumping back across the ocean or from whence it apparently or supposedly came, and now it's a black African disease, not just a white gay male disease or a gay male disease in the Western world, but suddenly we have it as a black African disease, which makes it a good point for us to talk about what is AIDS in Africa, Nancy.
Well, as I looked at AIDS, and first of all, AIDS in Africa is very different than it is in the United States. And as I looked at AIDS in Africa, it appears that it mostly is a lot of diseases that people have had historically for a long time in Africa. For example, one of the major AIDS-defining diseases in Africa is tuberculosis. And but the problem is that many of the diseases that are considered AIDS-defining diseases in Africa cross-react with the HIV test when that's done, which isn't always. So things like parasites and leishmaniasis and malaria and measles actually cross-react with the HIV test. But they also did something terrible in Africa. The World Health Organization came up with something called the Bangui definition of AIDS, which doesn't really require a test. It's simply based on a series of three or four symptoms. And those symptoms are nonspecific, and they could be associated with some of the diseases that people typically have, such as tuberculosis or malaria. So what we're seeing in Africa is a rebranding. It's a calling out of diseases that have been long known on the continent and calling them by this new name.
And they're not even really diseases, because the top four symptoms that qualify as AIDS are persistent fever, persistent cough, weight loss greater than 10% of your body weight, and persistent diarrhea. And, you know, those can be caused by a whole bunch of well-known diseases, or probably a whole lot of environmental conditions, poisonings from pollution or pesticide use or dangerous cosmetics or things like that.
We should point out here that in Africa, a lot of weakened immune systems come not from anything more complicated than lack of clean drinking water, carrying old pathogens, from lack of hygiene, from malnutrition. All of these things are immune suppressive that are going to allow the so-called opportunistic illnesses, meaning an illness that your immune system can't handle because your immune system is weakened. So you get a variety of diseases that then the white Western medicine world, when it couldn't make HIV cause an epidemic of AIDS in the Western world, decided to sort of offshore to Black Africa, where all of these other conditions were ripe for immune deficient opportunistic illnesses, and then we began to assign it to HIV. And that's a good point where we can talk about the economics of this, because what we've seen in the so-called PEPFAR funds is an opportunity to sell a lot of drugs from Western drug companies to people in Africa on the theory that they need to have their have to suppress retroviruses in them. Talk a little bit about that phenomenon, Nancy.
Well, you know, it's been known for well over 100 years that there's a direct relationship between how well a country is doing economically and its disease output. For example, over 100 years ago in the United States, there was a lot of tuberculosis. And as people began to understand that tuberculosis was a communicable disease, they began to isolate people, but people began to have better diets. Because of the workers' movements and the unions, people began to make more money, and they were able to buy housing in less crowded conditions. And also the sanitation started to improve. So that the health began to improve. The health began to improve because of infrastructure and because the society became a little bit more wealthy. This has been known for a long time. Yet in Africa, what has happened since the end of the Second World War with the imposition of structural adjustment programs and the debt load, that the countries are actually getting poorer. So the things that would make the infectious disease rate go down are actually getting worse, and so that people are getting worse. So instead of saying people need clean water and sanitation and decent housing, they are being sold drugs and vaccines. So that's beneficial to the pharmaceutical industry, but it's not very beneficial for the development of those countries or for the improvement of the health of the people in those countries.
And one thing we must talk about is mining, which is a big source of wealth and employment. I shouldn't say a lot of wealth. It's a big source of wealth in Africa, and employment for black men mainly. And yet many people in mines are exposed to fine particles of often toxic materials.
One of the things I found is that in the south, southern Africa area where there are diamond and gold mines, those precious things that they think are precious are embedded in silica and or asbestos. These are very fine particles which can actually tear the tissue in the lungs and make them ripe not only for cancer but for tuberculosis. So tuberculosis is a very big problem in the southern part of Africa. Now, the men from the mine aren't really told this. They don't, and before the fall of apartheid, they weren't, you know, they got sick and they were sent back to their villages. And, of course, the people, then the women and the children, began to develop tuberculosis as well. Now, what happened with the fall of apartheid, the mining companies now had the possibility that they could be faced with a lot of damaging lawsuits from the workers who had been injured for so many years because of their poor mining conditions. And interestingly enough, as the apartheid regime fell, suddenly pulmonary tuberculosis or tuberculosis in the lungs became an AIDS-defining disease. So now they were saying pulmonary tuberculosis was a sexually transmitted disease. Of course, this eliminates the possibility that the mining companies could have any responsibility for creating this problem.
Blame it on black male sexuality again. But one of the other weird things about the whole AIDS theory is that prostitutes, who presumably these miners, when they were away from their families, were using prostitutes in many cases, the prostitutes are not a risk group for AIDS.
Well, all over, whether you look at Russia or China or the United States, studies have been done in all of those areas, and they show that the only risk factor that seems to be associated with AIDS and prostitution are the use of drugs. And so, again, that takes us back to toxins in the body creating the conditions where people can develop these secondary infections.
Well, I think we've really pretty well defined the multifactorial theory. That really was the theory, the predominant theory that was beginning to take hold at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic as the real explanation for why people, gay men or black African women, really end up with an immune suppression that we have decided to label as AIDS, and we have decided to finger HIV, this mysterious pathogen, which, as Nancy has discussed, has really never been the cause of any disease. So just to sort of summarize here, instead of coming up with a single pathogen that the ethically challenged Dr. Robert Gallo and the sort of, I'll have to use the word wimpy, Dr. Luc Montagnier theorized as a possible cause of AIDS, instead of that being the cause of it, we have a multifactorial three-pronged approach here to why people had suppressed immune systems. Number one, old pathogens being circulated and treated with antibiotics, immune suppressive. Toxins in the form of recreational drugs, both legal and illegal, which were used to party lifestyles, immune suppressive. And then we should also reemphasize here that at that very same time in the early 1980s, we had gay men becoming a hated minority. And every physician knows, every human knows, that if you are fearful, if you're anxious, if you're depressed, it can make it very difficult for you to fight off diseases. Immune suppressive. So, in a way that an actuary for an insurance company can understand, studying morbidity and mortality, we end up with the real explanation for what was collapsing immune systems, a multifactorial theory, not a pathogen which Peter Duisberg and many others understand has no potential for causing a disease. Nancy, do you want to add anything to anything we've talked about here?
I was just thinking back to Africa for a moment. It was interesting in the House of Numbers when Luc Montagnier is being interviewed, he's
saying...
By the way,
let me interrupt. House of Numbers, if those listeners haven't heard it, is Brent Leung's great 90-minute documentary, which interviews all of the people who have been mainstream in the theory of HIV causing AIDS and all of the dissident community. And it's on DVD now, and you should go to houseofnumbers.com and see it for yourself. Go ahead, Nancy.
And I think it does a pretty good job of trying to understand what has gone on. But Montagnier, who received the Nobel Prize for this HIV business, is sitting there saying, oh, we think that there could be an oxidative stress problem, and that people could be, if they had a good immune system, they could be confronted with the HIV virus many times and never get sick, and if they had enough proper nutrition, they could overcome it. I mean, he's saying in the movie, he's saying what the so-called AIDS dissidents have been saying for 25 years, only he won't come out and say it in a very hearty way, but he intimated it in the movie, and I think that's rather interesting that he would do that, but not really take a public stand in another way.
I listened to Montagnier in the flesh about a year and a half ago, and it was interesting because he talked about oxidative stress quite a bit in his talk, but he was very careful not to directly link it with HIV and AIDS. And when he got to the end of his talk and he was talking about how, you know, nutritional therapies, he's a big fan of fermented papaya, for example. I think he has an investment in a company that produces the product, but he was talking about it, I think, in the context of Alzheimer's, and yet he had connected what he called HIV-AIDS to oxidative stress earlier, but he was very careful not to say that there are simple nutritional therapies that can reverse the condition that we call HIV-AIDS sometimes.
Basically, in Nancy and Dr. Banks here, we have a diamond, to use part of her book title, of someone who can understand the linkage between the political economics of this with her MBA degree and the medical science aspects of this with her Harvard Medical School degree, to put this all together, to explain to us. It doesn't really have to be a theory that some guy is sitting around a conference room engaging in a cabal and a conspiracy. This just all happened. It all snowballed. It spiraled because of a wide range of interests that came together to create what those of us in the dissident community call the HIV-AIDS industry, which is more than an industry. It's almost a religion, which was why we're so happy that we have Nancy as part of this dissident community now to put all this together for us. Nancy, go ahead.
But the thing that bothers me the most, though, and because of the an organization called the Epidemic Intelligence Service, who is a subset of the CDC, who are people who are not always doctors. Sometimes they're journalists. Sometimes they're in the public health sector. But it's their job really to promote whatever the CDC says is the law of the land. So if there is a SARS or a swine flu or this last year, which was this H1N1 bogus that came through, it's their job to promote that. And it doesn't seem to matter what the science is. And the thing that disturbs me is that it's almost like a psychological operation on the American people to sell drugs. And I am disturbed greatly that science is being undermined for political and economic gain.
Yeah, it disturbs me too. When I discovered that the CDC actually had an agency that's job is to manipulate Hollywood or movies or television programs to make sure that they include in them a message that's concordant with the CDC, the CDC's viewpoints. For example, they may encourage a morality tale where somebody who doesn't vaccinate their child has to suffer the consequences, you know, because she's listened to some crackpot who says that vaccination can be dangerous.
Exactly.
It scared me that here we have a supposedly neutral government agency that behind the scenes is manipulating what manipulates us, which is television.
all of these people all across the country immediately are going to be on the same page.
Right. I think your book, AIDS, Opium, Diamonds, and Empire, The Deadly Virus of International Greed, is a great antidote, and I certainly encourage people to read it. It has a lot of gems in it, if I can continue with the analogies. Would you like it to make any closing remarks before we wrap up the show?
Yeah, if people want to read the first chapter and see the chapter outlines, I do have a website, nancybanks.us, and the book can be ordered from Amazon or Barnes & Noble or iUniverse.
We'll put those links in the notes for the show so that people don't have to hurriedly write them down. They can just go to howpositivearyou.com, and there they can enter the discussion on this episode. You can register and you can give us your feedback, and you can also see the links about where you can read the first chapter and where you can purchase the book. Terry?
Nancy, thank you so much for joining us. This is very enlightening, and we look forward to talking to you again.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks to all our listeners. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you for your continuing support and feedback. It means a lot to us. If you're interested in sponsoring the show, please contact us through the website, howpositivearyou.com. Stay tuned for more great episodes and more great interviews of How Positive Are You? Goodbye.